Hello, I'm Rachel Babin from the Oncology Network. Welcome to the Oncology Podcast's Experts on Point series. Does cannabis have a role in cancer treatment? What does the latest research tell us about optimal use? What are the legal implications? In today's episode, I'm exploring medicinal cannabis with Associate Professor Peter Grimason from the Chris O'Brien Lifehouse Centre in Sydney. This is a topic of personal interest to me. When I was younger, a much-loved family member with a brain tumour successfully used cannabis for pain relief. It was very helpful for him, particularly towards the end. So I'm keen to explore the data further. And just a reminder that to access all of our free podcasts, including our brand new series on diagnostics called Beyond the Slide, registered healthcare professionals are invited to join the Oncology Network. Head over to oncologynetwork.com.au to find out more. I hope you enjoy listening. This is Rachel Babin, and this is the Oncology Podcast. Hello, Peter. Thank you for joining me today.
Thanks, Rachel. Nice to be here.
I always like to start with a personal question, if I may. When did you decide to become a medical oncologist?
So that's a really interesting question. I trained in Sydney and I was working as an intern at St. George Hospital, and I got to do a number of oncology terms in both radiation and medical oncology, and found the science of oncology really fascinating, but found the privilege to be with patients at a very critical time of their lives and help them through that cancer journey was a real interest of mine. And then I confirmed when I finished my basic physician training and began medical oncology advanced training at St. George and Prince of Wales Hospitals.
Wonderful. So have you always been based mostly in Sydney?
That's right. That's right. So I did my initial training in hospitals in Sydney, and then I've done research at the University of Sydney with a PhD focusing on clinical trials and quality of life and thinking about patient preferences for treatment.
Wonderful. And I hear you can often be spotted cycling around Northern Sydney as well.
That's right. So that's my mental health, to cycle along the beaches as long as the COVID restrictions allow. So that's been wonderful.
Yeah, there's nothing better, is there? Wonderful. And why did you develop an interest in medicinal cannabis?
So the opportunity to develop an interest and conduct a clinical trial of medicinal cannabis comes back to 2016, when the New South Wales government had a particular interest in funding trials to develop high-quality evidence about medicinal cannabis. My particular interest was looking at preventing nausea due to chemotherapy, and I'd already conducted a clinical trial of a different antiemetic for prevention of nausea in patients with testes cancer having combination chemotherapy. That trial was led by Ian Olver from Adelaide and a number of other experienced clinicians. So it was my expertise in clinical trials, antiemetics, and then an opportunity for medicinal cannabis.
Fantastic. So for listeners who may have missed your presentation at the COSA ASM, could you outline the aims and results of the trial you're currently running, the cannabis, is it the CINV, C-I-M-V?
Correct. So this is cannabis for chemotherapy-induced nausea vomiting. So back in 2016, we were funded by New South Wales Health to conduct this randomised trial, being run by the University of Sydney together with Chris O'Brien Lifehouse, a number of cancer centres around New South Wales, and with the aim to do the largest and most definitive randomised placebo-controlled trial of medicinal cannabis. It's an important trial because we have had trials 10 or 15 years ago of medicinal cannabis to prevent nausea due to chemotherapy, but that was when we did not have good antiemetics like 5-HT3 antagonist, NK1 antagonist, dexamethasone. But we did know that there is still a group of patients having chemotherapy despite all those antiemetics who still have significant vomiting or more likely have significant nausea without vomiting. And I think that's where there's still a potential need for medicinal cannabis. So in our randomised trial, everyone got the standard antiemetics, and it was a crossover trial where for one cycle, they also got an oral capsule containing medicinal cannabis, 1-to-1 ratio of THC and cannabidiol. And for the other cycle, they received matching placebo. And then at the end of those two cycles, they told us their preference, which cycle did they prefer. So it's a 250-patient study, We published the results of our first 80 patients based on the crossover design, and that was published in Annals of Oncology, which I presented at COSA, and then we're continuing to do the second part of the study, which has a parallel design looking at how well medicinal cannabis works over multiple cycles of chemotherapy.
Okay, fantastic. We'll make sure we include the link to the paper in the show notes so people can really look into the detail of that. Could you go into the details of the results for us, please?
So the results from our pilot study of the first 80 participants, the take-home message is that having cannabis rather than placebo did reduce the incidence of nausea and vomiting, and there are an extra 1 in 10 people who did not have vomiting or significant nausea or required rescue medication such as metoclopramide or haloperidol. This was a group of patients who were already experiencing significant nausea and vomiting. So the reduction or the improvement in control of nausea went from 14% up to 25%. So it still meant there were a number of people having nausea or vomiting, but definitely a 1 in 10 benefit. So showing there's a small but important benefit. We did find that people who had cannabis did experience more side effects. They noted sedation, dizziness, some disorientation, and in about a third of people that was moderate or severe. But the really interesting thing was that when we asked patient preference, on balance, considering potential side effects of cannabis, control of nausea and vomiting, which did you prefer? And 83% of people preferred cannabis to placebo. There was an editorial in Annals of Oncology published about our study asking, you know, why, when there's only a small benefit control of nausea and vomiting and side effects, why is the preference so strong? And I guess I can't answer that for sure, but I think, you know, it's probably there are additional benefits in medicinal cannabis. It can reduce anxiety, make people feel relaxed, perhaps giving people a pleasant high. And when people are suffering the effects of chemotherapy, I think those additional effects probably influence the preference and made it more desirable.
It's a very interesting observation that you say about how chemotherapy just makes everybody feel so awful, and anything that can be done that helps people to feel better, even if there are side effects, surely is a good thing if it doesn't cause any harm.
Yeah, so I think for people who are having quite severe chemotherapy side effects, we need to do better and investigate new drugs and other supportive treatments. I think it's also important to acknowledge there's actually many people these days who have chemotherapy who have very good control of nausea and vomiting. So I'm not recommending cannabis for everyone, for that group with unrelieved symptoms. I think we also learned in the study that it took us, you know, a number of years to recruit the first 80 participants, and there were a number of people invited to go in the trial who didn't want to go in. Some people didn't want to take medicinal cannabis because there's still a stigma around it. One important thing we'll probably discuss a bit more is an issue about driving. And at least in New South Wales, you're not permitted to take medicinal cannabis and drive. And if you have a random drug test, then if you're detected to have cannabis, then you could be charged and lose your license, even if it's for a medical purpose. So there's a number of reasons why I don't think that all cancer patients are going to be taking medicinal cannabis. They don't need it. Maybe the effect's too small, the side effects, the driving issues. But again, conducting really high-quality evidence can help us advise where it has a role.
Yes, I think that's very key, because I think this is an issue that everyone has a quite a strong opinion on, but there's not necessarily a lot of real data out there, or certainly recent data. So congratulations on the study. I think the driving issue is certainly a controversy. Did you find any of the trial participants stopped for reasons like that, that it affected their personal life so much?
So we didn't have any people who joined the trial stop, but we did need assistance with people, particularly in rural areas, who may need to travel a fair distance to have their cancer treatment or perhaps to attend work or family duties. And an important thing New South Wales Health did was provide taxi vouchers so people can go about their daily business. So I think that is a potential barrier. We'll talk in a little while about some research done by the University of Sydney about the effects of cannabis on driving and how I think it does have some important side effects. But, you know, hopefully we can generate more data showing that it can be safe for some people to take medicinal cannabis and continue to drive.
Yes. And do you know, for example, if there are exemptions, like how long the testing period might be. So say, for example, someone was involved in your trial and then they're pulled over and they're, you know, have a random drug test, you know, a month later, 3 months later, what's the timeline on that?
Yeah, so that's a really good question. So in our trial, we were quite conservative and said that people could not drive for 5 days after taking medicinal cannabis. Since then, there has been some work done by the University of Sydney and other groups. And certainly, it is less than 24 hours and probably less than 12 hours after cannabis that you cannot detect cannabis in the system using a saliva swab, which is detecting ingestion of cannabis from oil or smoking or vaporized cannabis. If you're actually testing the urine for cannabis, that can, as you say, persist for 30 days, but that would not be commonly done by the police as part of random drug testing. So I think people need to be aware of that. 24 hours would be a conservative view. We may talk a little more about this University of Sydney research suggesting that people at least having inhaled cannabis should wait at least 5 hours following ingestion before they drive because of some of the cognitive effects that could affect the safety of driving.
Oh, that does sound like interesting research. I would have thought that it would have been longer, actually. So it's quite interesting.
Yeah, and it's probably a bit longer for oral cannabis, which has delayed absorption. But for inhaled cannabis, which is very rapidly absorbed, this group from the University of Sydney, from the Lambert Institute, did a randomized trial. They actually did it in the Netherlands with students, and they were driving on a racetrack, which was closed off from the public, so it was very safe. And that's essentially what they found, whether you had THC or you had THC in combination with CBD, not CBD alone, that didn't seem to impair driving. But for those other groups, there seemed to be significant effects. They measured lane weaving, so whether you could keep the car straight or not. And most driving skills were recovered within 5 hours, as I said, almost all within 7 hours after inhaling a reasonable dose, 20 milligrams of THC. Now, I think there is a question, what about people who are taking cannabis on a chronic basis? They probably develop tolerance, and it may well be that it is safe to drive in that situation. But the New South Wales police are very evidence-based, they're very cautious, and I don't think that they would permit use of medicinal cannabis while driving unless there were studies showing that in people taking cannabis chronically, that it was safe to do so.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Gosh, amazing research project over there in the Netherlands. I'm sure the queue of volunteers for that trial was very long.
That's right.
And so how long has it been available in Australia for cancer patients? And is it easy enough for people to get? Like, how has uptake been?
So it's important to acknowledge that people have been able to access cannabis generally from illicit sources for many years. And that's most commonly inhaled, typically smoked cannabis. Also, cannabis oils can be obtained on the internet. In terms of actual medicinal cannabis, it's really since about 2016 that there's been a mechanism for patients to access that, having prescribed cannabis using pharmaceutical grade cannabis, where you know the consistency of THC, CBD, you know other cannabinoids that may be present, you know that there's not impurities of concern. So at that time, there was a mechanism set up by the federal government together with the New South Wales government that allowed import of medicinal cannabis, because at that time there weren't Australian medicinal cannabis manufacturers. That's changed. But also a mechanism for doctors to prescribe medicinal cannabis to patients. This is a very different way of doing things compared to most of the rest of the world. For example, in the United States, you go to a doctor, you get a permit to say you have a chronic illness. That's specified, and that's essentially a certificate that then allows you to go and purchase your own cannabis, and you can choose what product to have, the consistency, how often you have it. So it's a choice of a very medicalized model in Australia. The downside is that does limit access to cannabis. You need someone willing to prescribe it. The advantage, I think, is that it does mean that Australia really is at the forefront of doing trials of medicinal cannabis. Because doctors generally will only want to prescribe medication where there's research showing that it's both effective and safe. And given there's limited research at the moment, that there's interest in prescribing, then there's quite a number of trials of medicinal cannabis going on at the moment. So there's been over 170,000 authorizations for prescription and medicinal cannabis over the past 5 years, and there's now 10,000 authorizations per month. So medicinal cannabis is much more commonly available than it was a number of years ago. And I think that does reflect community demand, that they do now have access to products, and now both Australian as well as overseas products. I think we do still have limitations. We don't have any TGA registered products. They're all come by the special access scheme. And I think it would be good, or specifically no THC containing TGA registered products. There are some TGA registered products that are available for CBD for epilepsy and other conditions, but not those relevant to cancer.
And so is that something that you have identified, that the THC is the really kind of critical component?
So I think it depends on the particular situation, certainly for control of nausea and for management of anorexia. THC is really important. The CBD, there's a number of questions as to what the benefit is in combination with THC. One rationale for using it in our product is the cannabidiol or CBD does make people feel more relaxed, less anxious, can lessen some of the disorientation and other side effects of the THC. In contrast, something like epilepsy I mentioned a moment ago, CBD alone can have benefit. I think we still need more information in pain. There's lots of interest in having CBD alone, and the legislation has changed that you can get CBD as an S3 without a medical prescription. But I think CBD alone is going to be much less potent for cancer patients needing good control of nausea, vomiting, pain.
Okay. That's really fascinating. I'm trying to visualize, but how does the product work? Is it a spray? Is it something ingested orally?
So I think it really does depend on the particular situation. And for our trial, we're actually having patients taking cannabis in a chemotherapy suite, and having inhaled or smoked cannabis really is not practical. And we wanted a product that would last and give ongoing nausea control over a day. So we selected an oral capsule that people take 3 times a day. There's an ability to take more capsules if you need better nausea control, or less capsules if you're getting side effects, and that continues 3 times a day over 5 days. That's different to, example, treating for anorexia, where you want rapid onset, so you feel hungry and eat just for a short period. So in that situation, using vaporized cannabis is probably more practical. Dr. Mira Agar from the University of Technology is leading a trial with the palliative care group of using vaporized cannabis for patients with anorexia and other severe symptoms of advanced cancer. So it does depend on the particular situation. We're certainly not recommending smoked cannabis because of the potential hazards of smoking a product for lung health.
Yes, of course. So it is interesting, there are different types of products, you know, currently being tested. We interviewed Nathan Cherney recently for the OJC Meets, and he was talking about when he had testicular cancer when he was a medical student at Monash, so quite a long time ago. And his father, who was then a GP, was out trying to buy cannabis for him on the street, and the legal implications, the professional implications of feeling like you have no other choice but to do something like that is quite immense. Why has it taken so long to get from there to where we are now?
So I think that's a really good question. And I think what we spoke before about the mechanism that was set up to have a medicalized prescription of cannabis, funding by government to do trials, regulation by the TGA, prescriptions by doctors meant that these trials are now necessary. There were trials a number of years ago, particularly in the US, particularly using synthetic products such as synthetic THC, dronabinol, particularly for nausea, also used for anorexia and HIV patients. But they faded away, and the US changed their regulation, making it very difficult even now to do trials on medicinal cannabis in the US. Although the state governments in the US do permit use and purchase of medicinal cannabis, it's still prohibited at the federal level. So I think the US often drive a lot of medical research. Israel, to their credit, have continued doing medicinal cannabis research over time, and then Australia is really picking up the game now. I think the other thing to think about in terms of why things have taken so long. I think it's really recognizing, you know, where there is a need. We spoke before that there has been a lot of advances in medications to control nausea and vomiting due to chemotherapy, also a lot of advances in analgesia. So sort of a feeling, at least amongst the medical community, that we're doing fine. But I think with a lot of patient advocacy, there has been this recognition that there is unmet need, unrelieved control of nausea, anorexia, pain, and therefore, you know, important gap for research projects.
Yeah, and surely in an ideal scenario, a patient has an interest in consuming some sort of medicinal cannabis. The ideal situation is that they see their doctor and that it is dose controlled and that it's safe and that they're not risking their lung health. It's really interesting. Have you noticed reluctance from your colleagues? Is the oncology community open-minded to this?
I think generally there's a lot of skepticism towards medicinal cannabis. I think that really reflects the lack of evidence showing it's effective and safe, and a lot of the medical community is quite conservative in that way. So unless we do develop, you know, higher quality evidence, I think there's still going to be reluctance from many colleagues. I think there's a number of general practitioners who are more willing to prescribe medicinal cannabis. There are some oncologists and palliative care physicians who do so, and I think to their credit, many of the oncologists and palliative care physicians are keenly participating in research trials. The New South Wales Health is also funding the CARE trial, which is for people with advanced cancer, looking at the tolerance and benefits and side effects of cannabis. So there's a number of other research projects underway that are a good way to participate. And if we can develop higher quality evidence, perhaps that will change. I think the other thing that's important that oncologists do recognise is there are some potential hazards of cannabis taking it together with active anti-cancer treatment. The pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics aren't well established with chemotherapy, but at least on a theoretical level, for chemotherapy, cannabis is not going to make it less effective. However, there is a chance that cannabis could make it less toxic due to interactions with CYP enzymes in the liver. So I think, you know, taking a medicinal cannabis product where you do know the consistency and you take a similar dose over time would be wise. Something I presented at the COSA conference that's really important, a little bit of concern, is that cannabis could actually reduce the efficacy of immunotherapy for cancer. And it's very difficult to prove if this is the case. There was initially just some retrospective data done from Israel suggesting that patients having immunotherapy who were also taking cannabis did worse. And then the group in Israel did a prospective study over 102 patients, and they found that there was significantly worse survival for patients having cannabis rather than not. So they lived on average 6 months rather than 28 months, significantly shorter time to tumour progression. There are also less side effects of immunotherapy in those taking cannabis, which I guess in theory could mean that there's an interaction that immunotherapy is less effective. Now, I have to say this is not high-quality evidence. It's certainly not a randomised trial and you couldn't do it. You look at the baseline characteristics that favoured the cannabis non-users who tended to be fitter. They were having more effective treatment. They had less aggressive tumours or in less aggressive sites. So it's not a conclusion that taking cannabis with immunotherapy is a problem, but I think there needs to be significant caution. And I think a sensible statement at this time is you should not take both at the same time, have one or the other. And I think it would be really good to do more prospective clinical studies to try to understand what the potential mechanism is.
Yes, that's really fascinating. I mean, those results do seem quite alarming, but I do note what you say with regards to the quality of the study. Have there been any interactions noticed about other therapies, you know, radiation therapy, things like that?
Not that I'm aware of. So I think it's most likely to be a interaction in terms of liver metabolism that's going to be the issue, so much less likely to be an issue with radiotherapy.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And have you found the stigma around what you're doing frustrating?
I'm not concerned about the stigma. I very much went into this field wanting to develop high quality evidence based on my experience doing clinical trials. I do acknowledge that in terms of recruiting patients, stigma is a potential limitation. I think also engaging other clinicians, that the stigma can be a problem too. But I think it's actually engaging clinicians to do clinical trials is a really wonderful way for them to gain confidence in prescribing a new product, and also to feel that they're generating really high quality evidence to help other people in the future. So I think that's a really good way to get around stigma.
Well, hopefully, given some time, the data will start to speak for itself and make that job of convincing colleagues a bit easier for you. Are you hopeful for the future?
I think we're going to find areas where medicinal cannabis definitely has a place, but I think we will also find areas where it doesn't have a place or has a very limited place. So our pilot results of cannabis to prevent nausea due to chemotherapy showed an extra 1 in 10 people have control. So that's a meaningful difference, which is a benefit to some people, but it's not an enormous difference. And I guess that's what often happens in true life. There were some people in the community who felt that this was going to be the solution for everybody. There were many skeptics who thought it would have no benefit at all. But like many, many things, it did have a small benefit, a meaningful benefit, at a cost of some side effects. One thing we're also doing in our trial is to look at the potential cost effectiveness. For example, if prescribing medicinal cannabis meant fewer admissions due to nausea or vomiting, that could save the health system money and actually demonstrate that cannabis is cost effective and potentially could be funded by the government. At the moment, patients have to purchase their own medicinal cannabis. Depending on what you're taking, that could be $200 a month or more, which is a significant amount of money to people who've got many other costs due to their cancer, their inability to work.
Yes, $200 a month is a lot when, you know, financial toxicity can be so difficult for a lot of patients.
That's right.
Yeah, it's really fascinating. Well, I hope you can keep us up to date when you get some more results. And if you do start looking into some other areas, these nuances, it's a fascinating subject area. And I'm sure the listeners will really enjoy hearing updates on it. Are there any resources you'd like to mention? Any trial recruitments, anything like that, that you think would be helpful?
Yeah, so there's been some really good resources published by the TGA, the Therapeutics Goods Administration, which really goes through the evidence in particular situations for cancer and other patients, particularly what is the evidence for control of pain, nausea, anorexia. Also some recommendations in terms of safe prescribing. Prescribing within a trial is a wonderful way to prescribe safely. Otherwise, there's a good sort of anecdote of start low and go slow in terms of dosing, because you really do need to individualize it. I'd also like to mention the ACRE, which is a very good group that does collaborative cannabis research across Australia. And again, that's national funding. So that's the Australian Centre for Cannabinoid Clinical and Research Excellence. That's led by Dr. Jenny Martin, who's a physician and pharmacologist in Newcastle, New South Wales. So really good resources on the ACRE website. People who want to be involved should certainly have a look at that as well. ACRE's also published some really good resources in terms of how to go about conducting a clinical trial in terms of accessing appropriate products. One of the real challenges putting clinical trials of cannabis through ethics is that ethics don't always understand what's being done. There may be members of the ethics committee who have their own concerns or biases or skepticism. And so ACRE's got a really good resource in terms of how to streamline ethics applications and ensure patient safety. So some really good resources available. In terms of other trials, I did mention at the COSA conference some other trials being done in Australia. I mentioned that we're really leading the world together with Israel in terms of doing research. I've mentioned already some trials for terminal illness, the symptom control in advanced cancer. A group in New South Wales did an interesting trial in glioblastoma multiforme, which is, you know, is one of the most aggressive brain tumours, and looking at whether THC-CBD could help with symptoms relating to brain tumours. They did a randomised trial comparing high-dose versus low-dose THC in combination with CBD and found the one-to-one ratio seemed to be most effective. Now, interestingly, there's some very limited data saying in brain tumours that cannabis could have anti-tumour effect. I think we've got to be very cautious thinking whether that's actually true. But there are cannabinoid receptors obviously expressed within the brain. So in theory, that could be the case. in this randomized trial of two types of medicinal cannabis. They did seem to have better tumor control than a retrospective group who were treated just with chemotherapy by itself. But, you know, I certainly wouldn't be telling anyone that cannabis will control their brain tumor unless we had reliable data to demonstrate that.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for your time today. If you have a key take-home message, this is the moment for it.
Yeah, so thanks, Rachel. It's really been a pleasure to talk. I think the key take-home message is if you're considering medicinal cannabis, if there's an opportunity to involve your patients in clinical trials, I think that's really going to help us all to learn, you know, where does medicinal cannabis fit? Where does it not fit? How can we advance the field so patients who will benefit will be able to access it easier?
You're wonderful. Thank you, Peter. You've been listening to the Oncology Podcast's Experts on Point series, brought to you by the Oncology Network. To hear more podcast episodes, head over to our oncology portal at www.oncologynetwork.com.au. Registration is free for healthcare professionals and will give you access to exclusive content such as our new diagnostic series, Beyond the Slide. If you've enjoyed today's episode, please do share it with your colleagues. This is Rachel Babin, and this is the Oncology Podcast.